You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
So let's set this up. Up to this point, God's people have been enslaved in Egypt for 400 years. And over the last few weeks, we've established the kind of suffering and oppression that the Hebrews had suffered at the hands of the Egyptians. And God has spent many, many years preparing Moses, his man, to lead this rescue mission of bringing the Hebrews out of Egypt. And so now it's time for one of the greatest confrontations in history, one that we see really marks a changing point in Israel's history. So let's begin in Exodus chapter 7. We read, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Pay close attention to this. Tell Aaron everything I command you, and Aaron must command Pharaoh to let the people of Israel leave his country. I will make Pharaoh's heart stubborn so I can multiply my miraculous signs and wonders in the land of Egypt. Even then, Pharaoh will refuse to listen to you. I will bring down my fist onto Egypt. Then I will rescue my people from the land of Egypt with great acts of judgment. Then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord.'" So God states to Moses and Aaron exactly what his intentions are. And the first thing is, God was revealing himself to the Egyptians. First of all, their immoral behavior flowed from the false religion of Egypt. And what we're going to see is that these plagues we're going to cover tonight are really God's way of confronting the false gods of Egypt and their pantheon. Secondly, God was giving them a chance to change their minds. It's surprising that in Exodus chapter 12, verse 38, when the Israelites finally leave Egypt, that it says a rabble of non-Israelites went with them, along with great flocks and herds of livestock. So apparently it was not just the Hebrews who left the land. It was also some Egyptians who had placed their faith in God. So that's very interesting because it tells us that God was giving not only the Hebrews an opportunity to be redeemed, but also the Egyptians if they placed their faith in him. God was also revealing himself to the Israelites. We're told in chapter 10, verse 2, that one of the things that God wanted to do was mark a historical event so that their children and their grandchildren could look back on this event and remember how good the Lord was. Many of these Israelites had lost their faith and started to worship other gods. So they also needed powerful evidence to follow Moses and Aaron. Remember, they had been under oppression for hundreds of years. And if you've been in that kind of environment where you have been subjugated, it takes an incredible amount of escape velocity to free yourself from that. And so one of the things that God wanted to do was he wanted to put pressure on the Egyptians and to demonstrate to the Israelites that indeed he was powerful and he could rescue the Hebrews. He says, "I will make Pharaoh's heart stubborn." Now, this makes it seem as if God was sort of causing Pharaoh to disobey him, which causes some theological and philosophical problems, right? Think about this. If God is the one who sort of preordains everything that you do, every single choice you make, then why would he punish you for the things that you've done wrong if he's the one ultimately responsible for doing that? That's a real problem philosophically. So a lot of people, a lot of skeptics of the Bible look at a verse like this and say, see, this is just another contradiction that we see in the Bible where God is supposedly loving and just, and yet he holds us accountable for things that he causes us to do. Well, the answer to this is, first of all, it's a prediction of what will happen. The text makes it clear that Pharaoh hardens his own heart. Look at some examples here in chapter 8, verse 15, where we're told that he, Pharaoh, hardened his heart and did not listen to Moses and Aaron, as the Lord had said. And then again in verse 32, Pharaoh hardened his heart. So it wasn't God who was hardening his heart and causing Pharaoh to disobey him. It was that Pharaoh was hardening his own heart. Only later in chapters 9 through 14 do we find sayings where God hardened Pharaoh's heart. And in those cases, the actual Hebrew word, chazak, means to strengthen or to give courage. In other words, Pharaoh had it in his own heart to disobey God, but because of the consequences he was suffering and the Egyptians, God strengthened his resolve to go through with what he knew he wanted to do in the first place, because he knew the only thing that was stopping Pharaoh from doing it was he was afraid of the consequences. So he was strengthening Pharaoh's resolve to do what he already intended in his heart. Verse 10, so Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and did what the Lord had commanded them. Aaron threw down his staff before Pharaoh and his officials, and it became a serpent. Remember, they had practiced this numerous times. And you can imagine Moses and Aaron sort of working through this again. Okay, remember, when we go into Pharaoh's court, we're going to throw down the staff and it's going to turn into a snake. And you can imagine God being like, this time, Moses, make sure you don't run away, right? Like you did the first time. Okay, throw it down. Don't scream like a little girl. Pharaoh's going to be right there, okay? Then Pharaoh called on his own wise men and sorcerers, and these Egyptian magicians did the same thing. But then Aaron's staff swallowed up all of their staffs. Now, it's not clear whether or not they were using sleight of hand magic or if this was true occult power. We do know, though, that the use of magic in Egypt was well documented in the Westcar Papyrus, which dates from before Moses and Aaron arrive on the scene. There's actually one example where these magicians were able to turn a wax crocodile into a real one, according to the legend, by simply grabbing it by its tail. So very similar to what was happening here. And we know that the reason why God decided to give this as a sign was because the Pharaoh's the animal that he identified with was the cobra. So this was essentially God's way of saying, you identify your power with the cobra, the serpent, and I want to show you that my power is greater than yours. And that actually becomes a theme that comes up over and over again throughout this passage. So verse 13, Pharaoh's heart, however, remained hard, just as the Lord had predicted. Then the Lord said to Moses, go to Pharaoh in the morning, and as he goes down to the river, announce to him, until now you've refused to listen. Look, I will strike the water of the Nile with the staff in my hand, and the river will turn to blood. The fish in it will die and the river will stink. And so Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord commanded. Now, we're not sure whether this was real blood. It's not likely it is. But either way, whatever God did killed all of the fish and sea life inside of the river Nile. And it's not by mistake that he does this. God is taking aim at the Egyptian god Hapi, who is the god of the Nile. And it's also not coincidence either that the Nile was bloodstained from the previous Pharaoh who drowned all the Hebrew baby boys in it. So this really harkens back to the event that took place in Exodus chapter 2, where God was saying, remember that event where you killed all of these Hebrew children? Now I'm going to make the entire Nile River just red with blood. But again, the magicians of Egypt used their magic and they too turned water into blood. Pharaoh's heart remained hard and he refused to listen to Moses and Aaron. So Pharaoh returned to his palace and put the whole thing out of his mind. The Egyptians dug along the riverbank to find drinking water, for they could not drink the water from the Nile. So this is typical of the human heart, isn't it? When we feel under pressure, when we know that we're doing something that's wrong, it's easy for us to just sort of put it out of our minds, to bury our heads in the sand instead of confronting the real problem behind why we're suffering, which is usually our own fault. It says that the Egyptians dug along the riverbank to find water. So it's not that there was no drinkable water. Instead, the water from the River Nile, which supplied most of the water in Egypt, was defiled. And so they had to start working to dig these troughs beside the river in order to drink water. Exodus chapter 8. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go back to Pharaoh and announce to them, 'Let my people go. If you refuse, I will send a plague of frogs across your entire land.'" And of course, this was against the god Heket, who is the goddess of fertility. And Heket looked like a god with a frog's head. We're told, "Then they will come up out of the river and into your palace, even into your bedroom and onto your bed. They will jump even into your ovens and your kneading bowls." I mean, can you imagine this? You're walking around your house. You're slipping and sliding on these slimy frogs falling down. You get into bed and you turn over and there's this frog staring at you, croaking. All night long, they're chirping, keeping you up at night. You're sitting there kneading dough. One jumps into your bowl with dough, and you're just like, you know, who cares? I'm just going to fold it in. This would have been terrible. So Aaron raised his hand over the waters of Egypt, and the frogs came and covered the whole land. But the magicians were able to do the same thing with their magic. Then Pharaoh begged, and he begged, "Plead with the Lord to take the frogs away from me and my people, and I promise to let your people go." Moses said, "You set the time. Tell me when you want me to pray for you. Then you and your houses will be rid of the frogs." "Do it tomorrow," Pharaoh said. So Moses and Aaron left Pharaoh's palace, and Moses cried out to the Lord. The frogs in the houses, in the courtyards, in the fields all died. And the Egyptians piled them up into great heaps, and a terrible stench filled the land. But when Pharaoh saw that relief had come, he had become stubborn. So he says, "Please pray to the Lord, plead with him to make this stop." And immediately all of these frogs croaked. Okay, I'm sorry about that. That was... Oh, God. I apologize. So I don't know if you've ever been to the developing world, right? But there are like these open air markets. I've been to numerous open air markets. And usually as you start to approach the area where they are selling like meat and fish, I mean, you just hit a wall of stench, right? As you're walking toward that area. And you can just imagine, that's what it smelled like throughout Egypt, as there were these piles of frogs that were rotting and dying. Savage. Well, we're told that Pharaoh saw that relief had come and he became stubborn. Now, this word is not the word hardened that we described earlier. It literally means heavy, sluggish, or indifferent. And this tells us that even though we may be suffering, that it's easy for us, once we are feeling some relief from our suffering, to just feel indifferent to God, right? It's usually in those times when we feel the heavy weight of consequence because of something that we have done that we're most apt to turn to God or even consider whether he exists. And yet, when that disappears, when those consequences disappear, or let's say that suffering leaves our life, it's just back to normal again. Verse 16, the Lord commanded Aaron, "Raise your staff and strike the ground, and the dust will turn into swarms of gnats throughout the land of Egypt." So he says, strike the ground. And again, this was aimed at one of the gods of the Egyptian pantheon, Geb, who is the god of the earth. And so he struck the ground, and Geb was powerless to do anything to stop God and his power. Gnats infested the entire land, covering the Egyptians and their animals. Pharaoh's magicians tried to do the same thing with their secret arts, but this time they failed. So this is the first time that the magicians of Egypt were unable to replicate the miracles that Moses and Aaron were performing. "This is the finger of God," they said, the magicians. But Pharaoh's heart remained hard. So they proclaimed, "This is the finger of God." They're like, "This is undeniable. We cannot reproduce this." And when you look at these different plagues, it's easy to look at this with some skepticism. In fact, some Christian theologians have speculated that these are actually a chain of events where there's really a naturalistic explanation for why all of this is happening. For example, maybe there was a big storm in this area that brought all of the red soot from further up on the Nile River down into this area, bringing with it parasites and bacteria that killed all of the fish. And therefore, because of the rotting fish that was polluting the river, the frogs decided they were going to jump out of the river and onto the land, and so on. And yet, I think if you look at the narrative, that can't be right. It's just absolutely wrong for two reasons. The first is there are instances where Pharaoh says, "Pray for me to make this stop." And Moses says, "Name the time." And immediately when he prays, it stops. So that's obviously not a naturalistic cause of events. And secondly, when you look at the 10th and final plague, it was the death of all the firstborn males in Egypt, something that has no naturalistic explanation. Nice try. Verse 20. The Lord commanded Moses, "Get up early in the morning and stand in Pharaoh's way as he goes down to the river. Say to him, 'Let my people go.' If you refuse, then I'm going to send swarms of flies on you. The Egyptian homes will be filled with flies and the ground will be covered with them." This was a direct attack on the god Khepri, who was the scarab-headed god of Egypt. The actual Hebrew word for fly has a wide range of meaning that could mean beetle. And so Khepri represented the scarab beetle god. And scarab beetles were known for finding carcasses that were dead, laying their eggs, and then bringing life. And so God was saying, "This is my way of showing scorn upon your god, Khepri. But this time I will spare the land of Goshen. I will make a clear distinction between my people and your people." This is significant because in ancient thinking, the gods were local deities. They only had control over certain geographical locations. And what God was showing is, "I am the God that transcends geography. I am the God who created all things. These gods that you're worshiping, they're not even real." And the Lord did just as he said. Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron. "All right, go ahead and offer sacrifices to your God," he said, "but do it here in this land." Moses replied, "That wouldn't be right." "All right, go ahead," Pharaoh replied. "I'll let you go into the wilderness, but don't go too far. Now hurry and pray for me." Moses answered, "As soon as I leave you, I'll pray to the Lord, and tomorrow the swarms of flies will disappear. But I'm warning you, don't lie to us again." And so Moses left Pharaoh's palace and pleaded with the Lord, and the Lord did as Moses asked. Not even a single fly remained. But Pharaoh again became stubborn and refused to let the people go. Exodus chapter 9. "Go back to Pharaoh," the Lord commanded Moses. "Tell him, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, says, let my people go. If you continue to hold them, the hand of the Lord will strike all of your livestock with a deadly plague. But the Lord again will make a distinction between the livestock of the Israelites and that of the Egyptians.'" This plague number 5, was directed to Hathor, who was the fertility god that was sometimes depicted with a bull's head. The Lord did just as he said, and Pharaoh sent his officials to investigate, and they discovered that the Israelites had not lost a single animal. But even so, Pharaoh's heart remained stubborn, and he still refused to let the people go. Then the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Take handfuls of soot from a brick kiln and have Moses toss it into the air while Pharaoh watches. The ashes will spread like fine dust over the whole land of Egypt, causing festering boils to break out on the people and animals throughout the land." That would have been horrible. Imagine if your body was just covered in boils. When was the last time we saw this? Well, it was when the Redeemer of the Cleveland Cavs came and won a championship. Well, this plague was directed against Sekhmet, who is the goddess of healing. And, of course, I'm sure that all the people were praying to Sekhmet, and there was nothing that Sekhmet could do to help them in their disease. Two, he says, take handfuls of soot from this brick kiln. And if you can remember, this sort of speaks to the instrument of slavery, which now became the instrument of judgment. Those kilns where they were making all of those bricks, that back-breaking labor that they had to do, now became the instrument of judgment upon Egypt. Even the magicians were unable to stand before Moses because the boils had broken out on them. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. Then the Lord declared to Pharaoh, "There is no one like me on earth. I could have lifted my hand and struck you and your people with a plague to wipe you off the face of the earth, but I've spared you for a purpose, to show my power and to spread my fame throughout the earth." So he says, there's a reason why I've spared you. It's to spread my fame throughout the earth. The New American Standard translates this to show my name. To show God's name means to reveal something of who he is, his character. Just like when you look at his name, Yahweh, I am, it has deep meaning behind it. And so he's saying there's something about these plagues that I'm trying to teach you. And the first thing is that God is a God of justice. That he had watched for hundreds of years these people being oppressed, enslaved. While the Egyptians and Pharaoh were becoming rich from their labor. You know, we live in a time now where we see all sorts of injustice. I mean, it's happened throughout the history of humanity, but in our age, we get to see it in a way that people in the past have never been able to see it. I mean, just this weekend, we saw a horrific video of a man being beaten to death by men who were supposed to be protecting him. And I just watched that video, which was gut-wrenching, as he was on the ground pleading for his life, calling for his mom, who was just 100 yards away. And you see something like that, and you just feel angry, don't you? You know, God is not indifferent or immune to our suffering and the injustice that happens in the world. Here's the thing, no matter what political views you have, watching a human being beaten in the street like a dog and killed is something that should move us. And God is moved by that. He's moved by injustice. He is a God who will judge. And who does judge. But he's also a God who redeems. The whole point of this story is that God was going to redeem his people and free them from their oppression. And really, this becomes sort of a type of what he eventually would do with Jesus. That becomes clear next week. In the same way that God freed the Hebrews from the Egyptian slavery, God frees us from the enslavement to sin that we've been living under our entire lives. He sent his son Jesus to die so that we can live. The Bible says that God is not only just, he's also the one who justifies. That's what this story tells us about who God is. He says in verse 17 and 18, but you still lord it over my people and refuse to let them go. So tomorrow at this time, I'm going to send a hailstorm more devastating than any in all the history of Egypt. So this was plague number 7. And it was aimed at the god Nut, not Nut. And Nut was a sky goddess who brought evening and morning. Each evening, she would swallow the sun god Ra and then give birth to that god the next morning. And Nut was meant to try to protect the land from anything that was coming from the heavens. And apparently, she was impotent to do anything. Verse 19, quick, order your livestock and your servants to come in from the fields to find shelter. Any person or animal left outside will die when the hail falls. Now remember, this is Moses and Aaron speaking to Pharaoh and the Egyptians. God is giving them an opportunity to bring their livestock and their servants into their homes. If you look at all of the different plagues, most of them are kind of a nuisance, right? But this is the first plague where life could be taken. And so God gave them a provision as well. Some of Pharaoh's officials were afraid because of what the Lord had said, but those who paid no attention to the word of the Lord left theirs out in the open. So there were some who put their faith in God and what he said, and others who disregarded him, which doesn't seem like a big deal. But, you know, if this was in the middle of like a harvest or something like that, one day of work could have cost them a fortune. Not to mention, how would you explain to your wife these cattle in your living room? You're like, what's happening here? So Moses lifted his staff toward the sky, and the Lord sent thunder and hail, and the lightning flashed toward the earth. It left all of Egypt in ruins. Even the trees were destroyed, and the only place without hail was the region of Goshen. Then Pharaoh quickly summoned Moses and Aaron. He said, this time I've sinned. The Lord is the righteous one, and my people are wrong. Please beg the Lord to end this terrifying thunder and hail. We've had enough. I'll let you go. You don't need to stay any longer. So this is the first time where it seems like Pharaoh softens his position. Yet we know from the narrative that he has no intention of letting these people go. And again, this tells us a little bit about the human heart, where there are times where we're willing to admit that we're wrong, and yet it doesn't really change our behavior. That our words don't necessarily indicate what's actually in our hearts. So this tells us that a true heart change issues in real change in the outward life. So Moses left Pharaoh's court and went out of the city. When he lifted his hands to the Lord, the thunder and hail stopped. But when Pharaoh saw this, he and his officials sinned again, and Pharaoh again became stubborn and refused to let the people leave. All right, chapter 10. So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, this is what the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, says. How long will you refuse to submit to me? Let my people go so they can worship me. In other translations, like the New International Versions, it says, how long will you refuse to humble yourself? I mean, how many beatings has he taken and yet he's still refusing to listen to God? I've been there before where I've suffered the consequences of my own bad decisions, and I was like at the end of myself, suffering, and yet there was no thought in my mind, maybe I should turn to God. If you refuse, watch out. I'm going to bring a swarm of locusts on your country. They're going to cover the land and you won't even be able to see the ground. They'll devour what little is left of your crops after the hailstorm, and they're going to overrun your palaces and your homes and your officials and all of the houses of Egypt. So he said, not even a square foot of ground is going to be clear. once these locusts come. And I mean, this is kind of like my son's bedroom, where literally every square inch of their floor is just covered with clothes. And hidden beneath these clothes are little Legos, these sharp little Legos, looking to lodge themselves into your feet and make you angrier than you've ever been in your entire life. He's like, that's what it's going to be like. You're going to be walking on locusts. And this, again, was aimed at one of the Egyptian gods, Osiris, the god of the underworld, and he was responsible for protecting the vegetation and crops in Egypt. Pharaoh's officials now came to Pharaoh and appealed to him, "How long are you going to let this man hold us hostage? Let the men go and worship the Lord their God." So they basically get rid of the court etiquette and just speak frankly with Pharaoh, and they're just like, "How much longer are you going to let this happen? Your stubborn heart is going to end up destroying all of Egypt. Just let these people go. Who cares?" So Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh. "All right," they told him, "go and worship the Lord your God. But who exactly are you going to go with?" Moses replied, "We're all going to go, along with our flocks and herds. We must all join together in celebrating a festival to the Lord." Pharaoh retorted, "I can see through your evil plan. Never. Only the men may go, since that is what you requested." And Pharaoh threw them out of the palace. So Moses raised his staff over Egypt, and the locusts swarmed over the entire land of Egypt, settling into dense swarms from one end of the country to the other. Pharaoh quickly summoned Moses and Aaron, "Forgive my sin just this once and plead with the Lord your God to take away this death from me." The Lord responded by shifting the wind, and the strong west wind blew the locusts to the Red Sea. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart again, and he refused to let the people go. Finally, the Lord said to Moses, "Lift your hand again to heaven, and the land of Egypt will be covered with a darkness so thick that you can feel it. A deep darkness covered the entire land of Egypt for 3 days." This is the kind of darkness that is far away from the light pollution of major metropolitan areas. I don't know if you've ever been to Mammoth Cave National Park or been into a cave. They do this tour in Mammoth Cave where they take you into this large cavern in this large room, and the guide at one point says, "Okay, at the count of three, I'm going to turn off this lantern, which is the only thing supplying light in the entire room." And then she turned it off, and it was, I mean, what is being described here is exactly what it felt like. It was thick, right? They were like, "Put your hand in front of your face and wave it." And it was the weirdest feeling, where you're waving your hand in front of your face and you have no sensation that your hand is waving in front of you at all because of the darkness. So you can imagine how intense this was. And this final plague that we're going to cover was aimed at Ra, the sun god, the primary god of the Egyptian pantheon. And God was saying, this is a judgment upon Ra. In fact, Pharaoh called himself the son of Ra, the sun god. So Pharaoh called on Moses to go and worship, but without their flocks and herds. He's like, "You know, go, but you have to leave your flocks and herds here." And you know what Moses said? He said, "Why don't we try this? We're going to bring all of our flocks and herds, and you are going to supply livestock for us to sacrifice. What about that?" Well, Pharaoh said, "Get out of here. I'm warning you, never come back to see me again. The day that you see my face, you will die." "Very well," Moses said, "I'll never see your face again." Okay, let's review what we've learned here. First thing is that God was demonstrating his power over the pantheon of the gods of Egypt. Now, you might be a little bit skeptical about this, but God makes that very clear in Exodus 12:12. Where he says, "I will bring judgment on all of the gods of Egypt, for I am the Lord." So God was demonstrating that he is far above all of these other gods. In fact, those gods not only are impotent, they don't exist. They're a mere fabrication of the human mind. This was also a direct attack on Pharaoh, who claimed to be divine. If Pharaoh let Israel go after the first plague, all the gods of Egypt would have retained their greatness in the eyes of the Egyptians and the Israelites who were worshiping some of these gods. Secondly, this tells us that God will eventually judge. And this brings, I think, the divine dilemma of justice that you sometimes see. On the one hand, when God doesn't judge, we criticize his character. When bad things happen to good people, we say, where was God when all of these tragic events were happening, like the Holocaust or the injustice that we see in the world? But then on the other hand, when God does judge, we criticize his character. I can't believe in a God who actually judges people and punishes them and sends them to hell. Well, God isn't asking your opinion about his justice any more than he was Pharaoh's. You might say, well, I don't believe in a God who would judge. And you're entitled to that belief. But your beliefs don't change reality or what's true. You know, if there is a God who is all just and all powerful, who actually exists, then regardless of what you believe, you're going to have to account to that God, either now or later. Finally, God was incredibly patient with Pharaoh. God did not immediately judge him or the Egyptians, and that's because God is a God of mercy, who is slow to anger. I love this verse in Ezekiel 33, verse 11, which says, I take no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but rather that they turn from their ways and live. You know, God isn't seeking to punish us. He's not looking for us to make a mistake or make one false step so that he can judge us and punish us. Instead, God takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked. That's why sometimes we see evil persist in the world for longer than it should, because God doesn't want to see anybody perish. He wants to give everybody an opportunity to come into a relationship with Christ. Pharaoh's biggest problem was his pride. He wouldn't humble himself before God. And so really the application point for us is this question: will you humble yourself or harden your heart? For some of us who are trying to follow Jesus, there are things in our lives where we are refusing to listen to God. It's not only harming the people around us, it's also harming us and our ability to relate to him. And over time, that burden, that weight that we carry, will become so cumbersome that we'll find ourselves in a position where we're deciding whether we even want to follow God at all. And so evaluate your own heart. Is there something that God is telling you, I want you to listen to me, and you've been refusing for weeks, months, or years? You have an opportunity at any time just to turn to him and say, I want to give this over to you. Some of you here tonight have never entered into a relationship with God. Like Pharaoh, maybe you have been resisting or even rebelling against God. What God wants to communicate to you tonight is that he loves you. He wants to rescue you. He wants to redeem you from the life that you're living. But it's going to require you admitting that you have a problem and that you need God in your life. And the moment you do that, the moment you humble yourself, you're positioning yourself to experience the forgiveness and grace of God. Yes, Lord, this is a pretty heavy subject of judgment. And yet we know that judgment is a double-edged sword, that on the one hand, we feel resistant to you know, you being a God who is just and who will judge. But on the other hand, we cry out for that kind of justice because we see injustice happening all the time and see people who get away with doing things that are unjust. And we're grateful that you are a God who is going to be the final arbiter of justice in the world. I pray too, though, that we can reflect and see that you are a God who is extremely patient with us and who's shown us mercy even when we didn't deserve it. I pray, God, that as we continue our study here in Exodus, that it would strengthen our trust and belief that you are a God who redeems and a God who is incredibly gracious to people who don't deserve it. Pray that in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.